Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, the world's leading chip maker, TSMC, sees its profits soar beyond expectations as the world pivots to AI. Also in the closing weeks of the US election, we hear from business owners. Hong Kong's government moves to regulate tiny rented living spaces.
Our ultimate goal is to ensure that all these people living in these SDUs will have a reasonable living environment.
And clocks are about to change for many of us. But is there an economic case for ditching daylight saving time? And a reminder, you can contact us at any time on WhatsApp or send us a voice note. That number is +44 330 678 3033. +44 330 678 3033. Now, TSMC dominates the world supply of chips, the microprocessors that keep your tech going. And they've just announced bumper profits, up 54% for the quarter, well beyond predictions. Well, I'm joined now by the BBC's Ritika Gupta from our New York office. So, Ritika, this is a big boost for an already highly successful company, isn't it?
Yes, Roger, a big boost, and investors, they're liking the news today. You see the US-listed shares of TSMC are rallying over 10%. Now, this is the world's largest contract chip maker that posted better-than-expected results with a 54% rise in profits for the latest quarter. And what's even more promising is that their expectations for things are to get even better. It raised its target for annual revenue growth this year, and it's now expecting sales to climb roughly 30%. So TSMC's outlook, I mean, that should help to tamp down some of those worries that we've been seeing about investors perhaps misjudging AI and chip demand, or whether that's slowing down. And we've seen those fears swirling after the Dutch chipmaker ASML, you know, stunned the markets by reporting about half the orders that investors were expecting. So it's some good news today for that sector, Roger, and we're seeing other chipmaker stocks like NVIDIA moving higher along with it.
Ritika, thanks so much for being with us. Ritika Gupta there on the line from New York. Well, the reason behind all this, as she was saying, is the growing demand for artificial intelligence, though there have been question marks about that. But hanging over specifically TSMC, of course, is the growing threat from China to take back Taiwan by force. Just within the last week, there's been one of the largest Chinese military exercises around the coast and in Taiwanese airspace. So what are the prospects for this company? Joining me now is Chris Miller, the author of the book Chip War. Chris, thanks for being with us. I mean, this is a company that has built hugely on already a very good position in the market. It's talking now about expanding very widely. Is part of that trying to get outside Taiwan and therefore, I guess, out of China's crosshairs?
Well, we've certainly seen over the past couple of years, both other governments and some of the big companies that are TSMC's key customers express a desire for the company to build a more diversified manufacturing footprint, relying a bit less on manufacturing in Taiwan and building facilities in Japan and Europe and in the United States to provide some of that diversification.
And I mean, is the secret of its success, however, that it is in a place in Taiwan, which obviously provides a lot of boosts for a tech company to get set up and get working. And that, I suppose, is an advantage as well.
Well, that's the dilemma. Taiwan is right now the most efficient place in the world to manufacture chips. It's got the supply chain. It's got the trained workers. It's got all of the components that you need to manufacture cutting-edge chips at scale in a very efficient manner. And so TSMC is trying to strike a balance. They want to respond to customers' desire for diversification, but they also don't want to undermine the efficiency on which TSMC's success has been built.
Now, of course, you know, we don't expect imminently a Chinese attack on Taiwan, but they made it pretty clear that they want Taiwan to be formally part of China again and are prepared to use military force to do it. What effect would that have if there were an invasion in terms of a company like TSMC and therefore on global chip production and what powers our tech?
Well, TSMC itself relies on a highly internationalized supply chain, chemicals imported from Japan, components imported from the US and Europe. So any sort of military scenario would immediately disrupt chip production in Taiwan. And because TSMC is the world's largest chip maker, manufacturing supply chains from Europe to Asia depend on it. The best studies that have been done estimate that the cost of any sort of disruption to chip making in Taiwan would cause trillions of dollars of damage to the world economy. It'd be felt far beyond Taiwan or East Asia.
Now, we've heard, obviously, that AI is a lot of what's driving this, the push towards artificial intelligence. But as Ritika was telling us just now, another company, SML, in the Netherlands, has rather had to pull back a bit, the sense perhaps of some of the steam going out of that push towards AI. Is that going to affect TSMC?
Well, I think TSMC has actually been the beneficiary of the increasing concentration of the production of AI chips at TSMC. TSMC officials recently said that they produce 99% of the world's AI accelerator chips. And the fact that they're a 99% player has left much less scope for some of their competitors like Samsung or Intel. And I think part of the slowdown we've seen at ASML is that some of their big companies who are customers like Samsung, like Intel, have been slowing the rate at which they're purchasing new chip making tools, in large part because most of the business is going to their competitor, TSMC.
So there's no actual slowdown in the demand for AI and what AI needs.
Quite the contrary. There's still extensive delays in terms of accessing the most advanced AI chips, which are designed by NVIDIA and manufactured by TSMC.
Now, what about TSMC's future? We mentioned briefly about them perhaps going outside Taiwan, but is this a company that can just grow and grow?
Well, for now, it certainly looks like that. There's no one in the world that's capable of producing high-quality chips in such an efficient and high-volume manner. And the fact that TSMC has, again, 99% market share in the production of AI chips leaves it very well positioned to capitalize on growth in AI. And I think as it begins to diversify its manufacturing footprint, it's addressing the key concern among many of its customers and many governments. And so I wouldn't bet against TSMC.
Isn't not worrying for the world to have effectively then a kind of monopoly providing these things?
Well, it is a worry to some extent, but it's also an extraordinary capability that only TSMC right now has to produce these ultra-complex processors that are needed for AI. If it were easy, we'd have more suppliers, but it's extraordinarily challenging. And right now, TSMC is the one that can do it rapidly, efficiently, and at scale.
Very clearly from their earnings. Chris, thanks so much. Chris Miller there, author of the book Chip War. Well, let's see how did all this play on the markets. I mean, the US markets have been open now for a little bit. Joining me is Natasha Ebdahaj, fund manager global equities at Artemis Investment Management, who's joining us on the line from London. But Natasha, I guess all eyes on Wall Street and how it's responding to this because chips are where it's at. How did chip stocks do?
Yeah, so no, you're right, exactly. There have been a lot of big moves in semiconductor-related stock prices of late. A lot of that has served as around whether the nervousness around the AI spend is going to continue into 2025, 2026. But the TSMC results today gave a good positive indicator on this, and that AI demand does remain strong. But semiconductor chips are not just for AI. We use it in so many other electronic items that everyday use, such as electric vehicles, industrial equipment, smartphones. And here there's more worry that demand is slowing. And if you throw on top of that the kind of the geopolitical struggles that Chris Miller has been talking about, and then also the certain big chip producers such as Intel and Samsung having individual problems, there's really a storm of demand signals moving around and moving in different directions that's affecting different companies differently. And that's what's causing a lot of volatility in stock prices.
Yeah, there certainly does seem to be quite a lot of that around. Let's turn our minds, though, to what's been going on in Europe, and particularly, of course, the European Central Bank, which has announced, as expected, a cut in the interest rate, quarter of a percentage point. In fact, the ECB's president, Christine Lagarde, said economic activity in the 20 countries using the euro currency was rather weaker than expected.
While industrial production has been particularly volatile over the summer months, surveys indicate that manufacturing has continued to contract. For services, surveys show an uptick in August, likely supported by a strong summer tourism season, but the latest data point to more sluggish growth. Businesses are expanding their investment only slowly, while housing investment continues to fall. Exports have weakened, especially for goods.
ECB President Christine Lagarde then. Natasha, so interesting words from her on that. Is there a risk of a euro area recession?
Well, this is the cuts are very much in response partly to a more tepid growth outlook for the rest of the year, with Germany being the particular weak link. At the moment, the consensus is that there isn't going to be a recession next year. But also inflation is also falling, which gives the ECB room to cut rates. So we're now at less than 2% on the inflation for the eurozone. First time we've been down there since the summer of 2021, and the market is pricing in more cuts. We're down for another percent by March.
We'll see if it happens. Thanks so much for being with us, Natasha. Natasha Ebdahaj there. Now, the US election is under 3 weeks away. Much is going to hang on how Americans feel about their economy, what the current administration has meant for their pockets. My colleague Ed Butler has been speaking to three shop owners across the country about what it's like to run their businesses at the moment. He spoke to Danny Reynolds, who runs a department store in Elkhart, Indiana, Susan Post, the owner of Bookwoman in Austin, Texas, and first Dr. Margaret Barrow, CEO of the snack company It's Nola, based in Brooklyn, New York. Ed asked her what was on her mind ahead of November's vote.
Of course, I think all of us want them to support small businesses a lot more than we've seen the credit card swipe fees. You know, we really would like a government to come in and really be open to reaching across the aisle. This kind of bickering and fighting all the time, it really hurts businesses in America.
So just
really
explain what that is. So that you're being charged every time there's a swipe, basically, for a credit card.
Yes, you're being charged every time someone buys. So let's say you have 10,000 people purchase from you. That's 10,000 times you get charged. It's not just a day, but it's each time. And so small businesses are really struggling because if you're paying out so much in those swipe fees, you can't really hire people that you need to hire. You can't really grow your business in the ways that you need to. And so these big banks are making billions of dollars. We're not asking them to get rid of the swipe fee. We're asking them to bring the interest rates down. We're asking them for competition.
Danny?
You know, as business people, we are able to negotiate nearly everything from our rent to, you know, our inventory prices, things like that. These credit card swipe fees, which represent 95%+ of all transactions for all small businesses these days, are one of the only costs in our business that we are not able to negotiate. It's a closed duopolistic environment between Visa and MasterCard. All we're asking is that it gets opened up to other credit card processors. No guarantee it's going to bring prices down, but I think we all know what competition does.
Susan?
Well, bookstores are unlike other businesses. Books, you can't raise the price of a book to cover the new credit card fees. And so historically, this has been a really hard business because, you know, the price is printed on the book and we can't really negotiate that. There have been suits to try to level the playing field because the big chains had a secret deal. They got better discounts. And so some of those have been rectified, but still we cannot raise the price of a book. People want discounts. Bringing those fees down will help a little bit. Helping women, helping with childcare and raising salaries will really help my bookstore. Because women just don't have as much money as men.
I guess this applies to all of you. You are affected by the microeconomies where you are, right? I mean, just to return to you, I guess, Danny, it's a bellwether town, you're telling me, in Indiana there where you're based. It's the town where the economy either thrives or sinks, somehow in sync with the rest of the United States. Is there a sense that people at the kind of the lower end of the income stream are really struggling still?
Yeah, so Elkhart's an interesting area. There's a lot of industry here, as I mentioned in the beginning. There's also a lot of money made in this town. So we have a lot of white-collar executives. We have a lot of industrial workers as well. So we sort of see both. And what we've really been noticing of late is some apprehension in people. We specialize in special occasions, bridal salon, proms, dances. Special moments in people's lives are kind of our thing. And so those are oftentimes big expenses for people. So we're seeing a lot of, I'm just going to say, price awareness right now. And during the pandemic, when people weren't going to hotels or cruise ships or flying to exotic vacations, they started buying RVs and motorhomes and getting with their family and taking off. And so our town saw business like it never has before. And everything was great. Well, now if everything's gone up, so consequently, the last year and a half to 2 years has really been struggling. And so I guess obviously that's where we're looking for some relief with regard to interest rates and things like that.
Interest rates, is that your experience too, Margaret? Things like this are going to affect very much the bottom line and your success as a business.
Well, I had been thinking about getting a loan, and it's just not the right time. The interest rates are so high right now. I think a lot of businesses, even some of the larger businesses, are waiting. Because you really can't move your business forward if you have this, impending feeling that interest rates could go up, which would be terrible.
Susan?
Well, I think, interest rates are sinking many deals. There's a couple of apartment complexes within maybe half a mile of my bookstore that are not being built because of the interest rates. And so people in all their little houses will not be my customers. Childcare is high. If food prices are high, people can't afford their rent. People are now starting to move out of Austin, and the tech companies are laying people off, and we're really seeing the result of that. And I'm hoping that the playing field will be leveled for common people.
Susan Post speaking there to Ed Butler. Tell us what you think about all that. WhatsApp for +44 330 678 3033 is the place to tell us. You're with World Business Report from the BBC.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
World Service. Now, living somewhere in Hong Kong, one of the world's most overcrowded territories, can be tough. The city is notorious for tiny and highly expensive living spaces. And the waiting list for public housing is now over 5 years. But the territory's government has just announced new regulations to phase out subdivided flats smaller than 8 square meters. Winnie Wong, Deputy Secretary for the Housing Bureau there, told me what the new rules mean.
In Hong Kong, we have this type of housing in the private market called as subdivided units. In short, we call them SDUs. Basically, people will divide a large flat into smaller units for renting out to meet the needs of those people who want to live in convenient locations with easy access to their workplace or children's schools. As a result, they are prepared to accept a smaller living space in exchange. It's quite common in other major cities too. At present, Hong Kong has 110,000 households living in these subdivided units. The quality of these units varies. So to ensure that all these SDUs up to an acceptable standard, the chief executive announced yesterday that the Hong Kong government will put in place, through legislation, a system on the renting of subdivided units in residential buildings. SDUs meeting the required standards will be named as basic housing units. Those substandard subdivided units must be converted into basic housing units that meet the required standards.
But Ms. Wong, I understand also they have to be over a certain size. I think they've got to be 8 square meters or above. Is that right?
Certainly, certainly. What we are thinking is we have to set a minimum standard for these units. Apart from the size, 8 square meters, there will be other fire safety and building safety requirements. We are setting these standards. And don't worry, Roger, we will give time to the SDUs to do rectifications in order to meet our standards. Our ultimate goal is to ensure that all these people living in these SDUs will have a reasonable living environment.
But it won't help with what are called the coffin homes, will it? Those will go on, these really tiny spaces, little bigger than a single bed. They'll keep going.
We call them bed space apartments. These are currently being regulated by another legislation called Bed Space Apartments Ordinance. These type of beds, they are different type of housing option. The single people are likely to be staying in those bed space apartments because they are single, they have lesser requirement. What we are talking about, subdivided units, we want to have a guarantee on a minimal size because sometimes they may be a family of two, a mother and a child together. And so these are subdivided units. They are not the same as bed space apartments. And for bed space apartments, there is already currently regulation on these bed space apartments.
Do you think, though, you talk about these 8 square meters or thereabouts as being adequate, I guess, but a lot of people would say that it seems an extraordinary tiny space, even so, for people. Do you think it's enough for people to have that size place to live in?
We are taking a pragmatic approach, and this is a minimum requirement. And from the Hong Kong government point of view, we want our people to have as much space as possible. But we have to be pragmatic, too, because these subdivided units, they have been in Hong Kong for a considerable number of time, and we have to give time to rectify them. But then we will be having a stakeholders consultation starting from by the end of this year. We will listen widely to views of different people. And if they have other suggestions or other ideas, we are open and prepare to make adjustment. What we are doing is we have this proposal, but this is not final. We will listen to views and we'll adopt a pragmatic approach to gradually tackle this problem of subdivided SDUs.
Winnie Wong there in Hong Kong. Now, next week, Russian President Vladimir Putin will welcome the leaders of Brazil, India, China and South Africa to Kazan as the so-called BRICS nations look to forge closer economic and political ties. Now, BRICS nations account for roughly a third of the world's GDP, 40% of the world's population. And now the group's expanding. Saudi Arabia, UAE and Egypt are just some of the new countries signing up. So all of next week on World Business Report, we're going to be trying to find out what the future looks like for those inside and outside the BRICS group. Join us for that. Now, we're at that time in the year when in many countries the clocks are changing and the arguments are loud from those who think the whole process is pointless or even damaging to our health and to our wallets. Brazil has just announced that it's not going back to daylight saving next year. The procedure was abolished under the previous government in 2019. And there's a big campaign in Spain to get rid of clock moving. Their argument is that the practice is damaging to economies as well as to our sleep patterns. I've been speaking to Ariadna Guel-Sons, co-coordinator of the Barcelona Time Use Initiative for a Healthy Society.
Basically, when we change the clocks, we are confusing our biological system, and this leads to health issues. Most importantly, it usually leads to loss of sleep, so sleep deprivation. There's the studies that quote the loss of GDP due to sleep deprivation on 1% in average.
1%, that's very high, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Obviously, it's not only DST, but it's definitely a key contributing factor. And I think that usually we call it daylight saving time, like we are saving something. But the studies we have demonstrate that either energy is not safe, so we remain the same, whether we change or not the clock, or that we even spent a bit more because we are heating here in Spain, for example, during summer. We are cooling down our houses because it's really bright still in the afternoon, or the other way around. We are heating our houses in the morning in the winter because it's still very dark.
I mean, when daylight saving was brought in, Generally, it was intended for two reasons, really. One was to make it safer, I think, for children going to school in the dark in perhaps the more northern reaches of Europe. But also, there was the idea that farming would work better if we worked around that way. So that would help the economy. That's what people thought.
Actually, with farming, it's quite funny that it started like that. But for example, in the States, farmers are one of the big supporters of ending DST, because basically farming works with the light, you know, plants and animals are driven by whether it's their sun out or it's night. So changing our social schedules, which is what we are doing, and going against what would be the solar time, our natural time to say so, goes against farming dynamics. So I would easily rebook that.
Okay, well, in that case, why is it that we all still stick to daylight saving time? Because it may have started in Europe, but it's pretty much across the world.
Not really. So one thing is that less than 40% of countries in the world use DST. And actually, most of them have gone and eliminated DST in the last, I would say, 20 years. So the trend is actually to eliminate it. Why we still have it? Probably because people are not so concerned about it. They are not aware of the effects of it. And therefore, you know, politicians seek policies that have like big reward to their voters in democratic countries, something people are worried about and so on. So the change has not yet happened. But again, the trend worldwide is to eliminate it.
Do you think it will end in Spain?
I hope so. We are campaigning for it. It's actually not only Spain. It's the European Union that has to decide about it. And so the European Parliament and the European Commission already said that they were okay with abolishing it. So I hope that the European Union's member states can get together and get a consensus. So we have now 200 organizations that have signed a declaration in favor of abolishing it, amongst other measures around time organization. And we hope that this can help us pressure the European Union to abolish it in Spain and in the rest of the European Union.
But Ariadne, I'm looking forward to my extra hour in bed soon. You're going to deprive me of that?
Not really. I mean, not all of us are waking up or getting to bed at the same time. So we are not forcing anyone to get up at 6 or at 7. We are just changing the amount of light you will receive when you get up. So what we are trying to do is to have the brighter mornings possible, because we know, because chronobiology tells us, that the best for your body is to have as much light as possible in the morning, and to have the opposite, to have dark nights, because this is as well what helps us get to sleep, what guarantees a good night's sleep for us. That being said, if your work allows it, you are free to sleep however, whenever you want.
Well, that's nice, I guess. Ariadna Güell-Sons there of the Barcelona Time Use Initiative for a Healthy Society. And this is a prime moment where you can have your say on all this. Tell us what you think. I mean, do you think daylight saving time is good? Do you think it's bad? How much do you appreciate that extra hour in bed, if indeed you get it? You have to tell us on +44 330 678 3033. +44 330 678 3033. That's our WhatsApp, and we'll get your messages. But that's it from me. I'm off for a lie down. That's World Business Report.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news, with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.